Hey everyone, welcome back to Group Therapy. I'm one of your hosts, licensed psychologist, Dr. Jessica Rabin.
And I'm licensed psychologist, Dr. J.
And I'm licensed clinical social worker, Kristen Gingrich.
And I'm licensed clinical psychologist, Dr. Kristen Casey.
Today, we're talking all about death, dying, and end of life. So settle in, take a seat, and welcome to Group Therapy. So this is a big topic and one that many people avoid or feel uncomfortable talking about. So I wanted to start off the discussion by asking you all, what is your comfort level in talking about death and dying? And does this differ, like whether it's in your personal life versus if you're talking about it with clients?
I can't say I have a ton of experience talking about death and dying with clients, but I definitely, when I have, I've been decently comfortable with it. And I think I've gotten comfortable over the years talking about death and dying. I don't like sitting in it for a very long time. I think it's funny too, like being a parent now, I think I was more comfortable at like 24 talking about it than I am like now with a kid, because I'm like, oh, the realities. But I'm definitely much more comfortable, I think, even with age. Because I also have I think I have a better understanding.
Yeah, I'd say I'm probably pretty similar. I've had a good amount of experience with clients. I think because I talk about death, dying, and grief a lot within the content I make. So in the private practice, I attract a lot of those clients. I feel really comfortable with clients talking about it. But it's always that when you have to talk about it for yourself, it changes, right? It's like definitely moves along. But I agree, becoming a parent has made it more challenging than before. But overall, I feel pretty good. What about you, K10?
Yeah, with clients, I feel the most comfortable talking about it. I don't have a lot of training in it. I have a lot of training in grief and processing that part. When people are talking about their own experiences, like with death, I'm thinking about like the existential experience of death and dying and aging and all of that. Super comfortable talking with my clients about that. With in my personal life, it's a little different. I don't have many people in my life that are open to talking about those things besides my mom. Got a shout out to Donna. She is like the death and dying queen in terms of like talking about it, bringing it up. How do you know, just talking about all the different topics. But yeah, it doesn't really come up too much for my clients, to be honest with you. So I don't have that much experience with it.
Yeah, I think similar to you all, more comfortable talking about it with clients. I will say working in a hospital has definitely made me 1,000 times more comfortable talking about it than I was even like in graduate school, because I have to talk about end of life and death and dying a lot with my clients, with the clinical population that I work with, just being in the hospital, working with individuals with chronic illness. And in my personal life, I feel like I'm pretty comfortable talking about it as well. I've experienced a lot of death throughout my life. But I've noticed working with clients with chronic illnesses that are going to die and having to have those discussions, that has made me more open to talk about it in my personal life and not seeing it as like, I mean, I don't want to say not seeing it as a scary thing, because it is like scary, and shifting my perspective on what death is, because we're all going to die eventually, which it's people true. Don't like hearing.
I mean, it's true though. I wonder too, like culturally, I just think about the Western culture and how we might not be socialized to talk about it as much as maybe other places in the world. I always think about that.
I love that you just brought that up.
Yeah, absolutely. Because it wasn't even to pick on your words, Jess, in any way. But I think even the conceptualization that it's scary is sort of like a stigma in a way of like, and it's tied to personal and cultural. And I very much feel like here in America, that's more the norm is we fear death. We pretend it's never coming. We avoid it like the plague. We don't talk about it. And we'll do anything to sort of stay young and act like this thing is never going to happen. And yet it's going to happen to all of us. So I so relate to what you said, though. I was like, yeah, like, why do we avoid this?
Well, I think I feel like exactly like you said. I was going to say, at least in the United States or Western culture, we view it as this scary thing and we tend to avoid things that are scary or difficult. Mm. I would also argue, going off of what you just said, that because we do everything to avoid it, it actually makes the process harder, which reinforces that narrative. So if we lose a person in our life to death, then we didn't prepare for it. And you can't always prepare for death, but like just this global preparing for death or talking about it. And it was really hard because we spent time avoiding it. That's going to make us avoid even more because of how difficult it was. And it's that we're all therapists here. We know that avoidance cycle of anxiety, avoiding things that are hard and difficult.
I'm so happy you brought up avoidance because I think avoidance makes everything bigger. Like we're talking about, like when we talk about trauma, you know, avoidance is like the notable feature of, you know, some trauma symptoms, you know, of like, we just don't want to go there. We don't want to experience it and stuff like that. So I do think, just to your point, I do think it makes it bigger. And I don't know, I think over the years, when I really think about it, I was less scared of dying and death and that whole thing when I was younger, because I didn't feel like I was that like close to it, I guess. And as you age, it just changes. Like I think your view on death and dying and aging changes as you age, and who knows, it doesn't have to age, or doesn't have to age, doesn't have to go in that way. You could actually become more comfortable with the idea of death and dying as you age because you have more conversations. Like you said, there's more people that you might lose or more experiences that you might have with it.
I think sometimes, like, you know, with that age comes, again, those, the, just the reality of what age comes with. And it doesn't matter if you are 75 or 35. Like, it's actually funny because we just had this conversation, me and my husband, that we don't have wills. And we have a child. And we're like, we have to do that just to plan for his care. Now, his care, everybody in our family, in our immediate family, knows what we would like to see. But if we don't have that written on paper, that doesn't matter. We would hope that people would respect our wishes outside of that, but it's not written on paper, and anything could happen. And I think sometimes, like when we put things like, for example, like do you like things like life support, things like organ donation, things like those, like when you start talking about those things, it makes it real, even if the chance of that happening is still 60, 70, 80 years away. But when you talk about it, it's like, I'm making a plan for something. You're like making a plan for something that hasn't happened yet. But the reality is really important because, you know, family could be standing in a room trying to figure out what your decision would be. And that's, you know, that's really hard too, as individuals who might be grieving, of like, what did Aunt Susan want to do with her organs? What did Aunt Susan, did she want to be on life support or have a DNR? Like, and talking about that.
True. Yeah. I'm glad you said that. That's been a lot of my narrative with both my dad passing away at 41, my brother passing away at 25. It's like, does anyone think they're going to die that young? Of course not. Like, none of us do. But I think this is the part, I so love that you brought that up, KBI, but this is a part of like, we avoid something that's inevitable, but also we have no idea when. So then for me, in the grief of things and going through both those losses, I've learned how important having those conversations are. Because I'd like to think that I'm going to live to 100. But the reality is, by the time this podcast goes live, I could have passed away. It just goes back to, none of us know. We don't know. And it doesn't matter how healthy you think you are. But I love that we're being, not avoiding, we're leaning into this of like, how do we have discussions on end of life? How does our culture impact the way we think about this? How do we create frames for understanding death and dying?
It's so important. Because like you said, like nobody knows when they're going to die. And I think that, to everybody's point, when you have a loved one who passes away, a lot of times it could be unexpected. A lot of times you might not know how you might feel, you know, and if you have to make those decisions, it's really hard because you're in this state of grieving. You might be in a state of shock and you're like, what would Aunt Susan want? You know what I mean? And I think it's really hard to be in a place of grieving while also trying to make a decision that that person would want. I've been in that position so many times before, just in the past 2 years. And I just never know how to do it. You know, it's just like never, like I always feel like I'm going to make the wrong choice or is this what really what they want? Or like, you know, I don't know, everybody has different life after death beliefs, but I'm always like, if we join up again, are they going to be like, bitch, why'd you keep me on life support? Like, you know what I mean? I always think about these things like, and you want to make the right choice. Like you do, but it's scary. For me, it is. I'll just speak for myself. It's scary making a decision that big for someone who doesn't have consent, you know?
And so, well, like when we talk about the things that we want and whether that changes with time, right? What I want at 32 years old is going to be different maybe than what I want at 92. Like I'm at 32, I probably would like to be resuscitated, right? And that conversation too, that happens through life. At 92, I probably don't want to be because of the detriments that come with that, that, you know, studies have shown in that and the impact on the body that that has. And so that's why it's important to constantly have those conversations with even with your loved ones and up and like having those documents in hand, even if they're scary, because we're going to leave that choice up to people who maybe don't know. If we've never had those conversations, if you've never had that conversation, no matter how scary it is, regardless of if you're 32 and relatively healthy, like Justin said, like we could, someone could not be here next week to record the podcast for whatever reason. And yes, is that sad? And yes, is that scary to think about? Absolutely. But if we just have even some of those surface level conversations, we can avoid a lot of those things and make sure our wishes are held to where our, that there are wishes and not the wishes of other people.
Well said.
Going back to something Justin said about like, how do we even have these conversations? I've found like in my personal life, not professional life, a lot of these conversations happen more naturally when a life event happens, such as the death of a loved one, or going off KB, what KBI was saying earlier about not having wills and having a kid. I made my will the couple days before I had a C-section and I got my healthcare power of attorney. And I still remember like the nurse being asking, cause they asked all those questions and I was like, oh yeah, I have all the documentation here. And she was shocked at how old was I? 31 years old, I had all that paperwork in place. And I was like, I'm about to have a major surgery to birth my child. Like anything could happen. Or, you know, I've shared on this podcast, one of my best friends from undergrad died of a brain tumor very suddenly. That prompted me to reestablish with primary care and have conversations with my husband about my wishes and goals. So I feel like when you experience some type of big event, such as death, that can be a natural introduction to having conversations about your wishes, goals, things like that. Because I think, especially if it is kind of going off what Justin said, something that's maybe more sudden or somebody that's young, it really shifts perspective. At least it has for me and made me really think of like, how do I want to live my life? What does this want to look like? Do I want to be resuscitated? Do I want to be put on life support? What are my, you know, okay, I'll be okay with a feeding tube, but not a ventilator. Like all of these things that people don't want to talk about because it's not typical conversations that we're having.
Yeah, I was thinking, what is everybody's experience like when clients bring stuff like this up? Or, you know, just say a client came to you tomorrow and said like, hey, I want to have a discussion about this stuff. Or, you know, I've been thinking about what life might be like later down the line about a DNR, about what I want or choices. How might you go about it? Like any just raw thoughts?
Yeah, it's funny you said that because it's like almost sad in a way that the norm that that gets brought up is only around death anxiety. Which I think is great, you know, to explore and bring up in you know, therapy. But as we explore all the things, it's interesting how it's, you know, come up in different conversations. But with death anxiety, it's a lot of creating frames of meaning and mm-hmm. frames of understanding. And, you know, sometimes that includes religion. Sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it includes, you know, understanding the nature of what you think of this life and death cycle that we're on and venturing into the unknown. But I think we do better with the unknown when we understand what our frames of meaning mm-hmm. and understanding are. It's vast. Like, I think in all the categories we explore as therapists, I think exploring death, life after death, end of life is one of those with so much unknown because none of us know. Like, even mm-hmm. if you're one of faith, you have a great frame, and I think that's beautiful. But it's interesting that it's something we can explore and come to acceptance to and lower anxiety on, and yet there still be that unknown.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think my experience is probably a little different given the context that I work in, because these conversations usually come up out of a terminal diagnosis of some sort. So it's less of the, like, I've been thinking about this, I want to have conversations about it. And it's more like, I received this diagnosis from my doctor, so this is my reality. Mm-hmm. So one thing we do in the hospital with teens and children, if they're able to engage, is something called voicing my choices. And it's really just giving the child or teen the voice to say what they want. So, you know, obviously we would talk about, like, how they want to be comforted during treatments, things like that, how they want to be supported. If they can't make medical decisions, who are their trusted people, treatments that they do want, they don't want. And obviously, like, at the end of the day, depending on their age, parents ultimately get to make these decisions, but it's really helpful, especially for my, like, younger teens who know what's going on. And it really allows them to have an open discussion. And it's a hard discussion because, like, most 14-year-olds don't want to be thinking about these things, but it's also very empowering. And going back to the word meaning that you said, Justin, it gives them, like, a sense of meaning and control. Like, this, if I can't control the fact I got this diagnosis, I can have choices in how I want to proceed with this. And I also do a lot of, like, values work with my clients as well, which goes back to meaning. Like, how can I still live a valued, aligned life? Whatever that looks like, whether that's the next 3 months living in the hospital, will it be for years? But I love that you brought up meaning, because I think that's a big thing when talking about death, dying, understanding worldviews, perspectives.
I would say for, like, myself, in the few instances that I've had, like, processing with clients, it's really, like, just like you said, like, giving them the space to really just talk about what their wants are. Mm-hmm. Most of mine, like, if I've worked, it has been more of that end of life. And it's really just been like, what are your wishes? Like, you know what your family's wishes are. Your family wants you to do chemo. Your family wants you to have an actual funeral. Your family wants these things. But what is it that you want? And how do we advocate for what you want? Do you want to align with the things that your family wants? That's okay if that's something that you want to do. But if you don't, how do you advocate for yourself in that situation that says, no, I don't want to go through chemo. Yes, I want a DNR as I go into surgery. My family wants me to have it, but I don't. And how do you even then have those conversations with your family? Because I think that that's also hard, coming from the person who is having to make those decisions of, like, how do you tell your family that you want a DNR? And that's a really, you know, that's a really hard conversation, because now you are then dealing with their reaction to precipitatory grief.
That's a good point.
And just how difficult that those conversations can be too. I would say that's been my only true experience, is more of that palliative care.
Yeah. I really like that you voiced, because I feel like this could generalize to almost anything. Like, you have a wish and your family might not agree, right? So it's like that really weird experience of like, I really feel this way and this is values aligned for me. And how do I break it to my mom, or how do I break it to my partner that this is like what I want? I actually have more experience working with death and dying as an EMT, obviously, just because mm-hmm. of my job at the time. So I was, not that I would process like we would in therapy, but really acknowledging like, this is death. This is what it means. They're not coming back. Like, kind of doing a lot of psychoeducation on the death and dying process and like the physical attributes of death. But in therapy, I have a couple of clients, or I've had a couple of clients at least this year, where we're talking about grieving, like, you know, their parents or a partner or something like that. And then it always comes up. They always think about their own mortality. Like, it always seems mm-hmm. to be intertwined. And when we do process it, I just, like all of you, just try to create that open space, because I think if they feel comfortable enough to bring it up here without judgment, you know, and, you know, we're helping them through it, what a beautiful thing, you know, because maybe they just feel uncomfortable talking to a partner or somebody else. And it's easier to have the conversation with your therapist first, you know, before you go to your partner mm-hmm. to talk about it. But yeah, I don't have many experiences talking with clients directly about it, unless it's wrapped up in other grief. You know, it just seems to pop up in that way. I don't know if anybody else has that experience too.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I'd say it's just interesting. I'm just back to the topic itself of why people feel it's hard to talk about, or why we avoid it, and thinking about how, yeah, it almost has to be triggered for us to be, to lean into it instead of avoiding, which there's an awesome book called Being Mortal. It's so incredible. It's this doctor's experience about basically how we will do everything to avoid death, sometimes to the detriment of our loved one, of keeping mm-hmm. them alive. And it's such an eye-opening read. I know there's always books people are going to recommend, but it definitely changed the way I think about things. And I think us even having this episode and having this podcast and trying to get people to lean towards it, to think about what is your understanding of this thing called life that we're doing. But mm-hmm. I think in therapy, it's so beautiful because it's such an open-ended exploration. But the reason mm-hmm. is almost everything else you're going to explore, there kind of is cost benefits. There's individual differences. We're not telling you exactly what you should do with your anxiety or exactly what you should do with your depression, but there's kind of some bigger guideposts we can sort of use. But I think even us as therapists, there's not, in terms mm-hmm. of this, except the overall truth, which is anything psychological, if you avoid it, it tends to only harm you, versus mm-hmm. taking space to lean in, come to understandings, and make meaning.
Or it becomes more stressful, you know? It just becomes oh my God, now it's this big ball of stress. What do I do with it? You know? I think it's tough, you know. I think the more that you lean in, the easier it gets, you know. And I've had my own experiences the past couple of years contemplating my own mortality after getting sick. And I was like, how do I want to go? You know what I mean? Like, having that conversation with my partner was really, really hard after going under general anesthesia a couple of times. And I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't really know what I want. And I was like, why is everybody pressuring me? Chill. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? It was just like so stressful. And I'd imagine that if I were to process this with my therapist, it probably would have been a really easy way to explore and get to even know myself more, you know? So I think when we talk about the cost benefit, you could always learn more about yourself when you think about topics like this. And when you choose to explore and not avoid, it could be a really beautiful journey. But it's also kind of wrapped up in potentially some pain, depending on if we're kind of attached to life in a different way. It depends on faith, I think, and spirituality too, and culture.
Yeah. Yeah. You all brought up so many great points. Like, one thing that was coming to mind on the avoidance piece is, if we don't talk about it, we may not even know like what our options are or things like that. Exactly. Yeah. Like you were just saying, K-10, like I have no idea. Like, I know for me, working in a hospital really was what was so eye-opening to me about, oh, wow, there are so many different options and avenues. But if we don't know like even what a DNR is, or, you know, code status, like these terms, like how are you supposed to know what your choices are or what your wishes are when like, I don't know, it's just not something that you've experienced. And then Justin, when you were talking about the book and like sometimes we, I can't remember exactly what you said, but we keep people alive, even to the detriment. I've seen that a lot too, working in the hospital, and how I conceptualize things, and there's no right or wrong answer for this, but especially having conversations with families, is generally speaking, there's two camps of people, the people that want to be alive and the people that want to be living. And so some people really value like life, like, I want to do all the interventions. I want to stay alive as long as possible. I want to keep my child alive as long as possible, regardless of what that is, mechanical ventilation, things like that. And then there's another camp of people that are very much like, no, the quality of their life is what matters, or the quality of my life. So, you know, if I can't do X, Y, and Z, that's fine. However, if I can't eat by mouth or be able to communicate, that's when I draw the line. And those are hard things to think about as well. Like, especially if you are a relatively healthy individual, conceptualizing your life that looks very different can be a challenge because you don't know what it is. But K10, going back to kind of making you reflect or having a space in therapy to really dig into like, what do I value? What would life look like? Like, are there things that you're like, yeah, I wouldn't mind if, and I don't want to give specifics because everybody's values are going to be different. Like, yeah, I wouldn't mind having X, Y, or Z, but this thing over here, absolutely not. And there's not a right or wrong answer. So I think that's hard too, because we talked about how could I communicate to somebody I want a DNR, because their values might not align. But at the end of the day, it's about what aligns with who you are. And what would give you meaning, values, et cetera. Another thought I had, because we're talking about a lot of avoidance, at least in Western culture, do you feel like there's like a stigma around like talking about death? Because like I've definitely heard at times like, oh my gosh, don't be so morbid, or like people like will brush it off, which can go into avoidance, but wanted to get your thoughts about like, or even making different choices than other people, like a stigma of like, why, how could you choose a DNR or hospice care? Why aren't you fighting more? I don't know if anybody has thoughts on that kind of stuff.
I think it really depends on who you talk to. You know, I think when I think about people who are chronically ill, it's probably easier for them to talk about because they've had to think about it potentially. You know, if I think of people who might have a tendency to avoid hard topics, maybe it's harder, you know? So in terms of a stigma, I don't know if it's, we feel uncomfortable as a society talking about it, or we just don't have enough opportunities to, I don't know. And then I think about culture, and I think about spirituality, and a lot of the people in my social circle who are incredibly, incredibly spiritual, these topics seem to come up and with ease, you know what I mean? Compared to my friends who might not be embedded with their faith or spirituality in some sense. So I do kind of think that that might be some mediating variable. When I think about the people in my life who I could easily talk to about it, it seems like it, and I don't know if this is accurate for anybody else, but it is for me, people who are older than me, it seems like way easier to talk to them about death and dying and aging and anything that might be around it. But then not so much, because I think about the younger people in my life too, and they're like, I don't know what's going to happen when I die. Like, they're curious, you know? So I think it is hard to say, but I think it depends on your values too.
Yeah, I think death and dying counters a lot of stereotypic American values of keep working harder, do better, try harder. And that gets tied into this medicalized philosophy of, no, like, we must do this, we must do that. There's this treatment, there's this thing, there's that. Like, you must keep going. I think it's just, we have just, in a nightmarish way, an awful clash with medical and American values that makes us avoid any conversation about death. And to me, it gets to the point where maybe I'm influenced by some of the literature I've read, but I think it becomes very unnatural to avoid death to the extent that we do, especially, again, American culture is a diverse culture, but I'm talking more broadly comparative to other cultures where death, the cycle of life, living and dying, it's ingrained in how you think about creating a day and purpose. But in our culture, I think, again, broadly speaking, less so, until, you know, chronic illness or something else kind of comes up. But I, again, I'm really biased. I think it's to our own detriment, because the thing I'd say to you, if you're really like, oh, this conversation is really hard, is like, you have frames for everything else in your life, frames of understanding of why maybe a relationship didn't work. Okay, some of you are still trying to figure that out, but how you're going to get that new job, or like, you know, what's your plan for the vacation? You have frames of understanding, or you try to, with almost everything in your life. And then with the one thing we're all going to experience, we avoid. It's just, there's something that I always go back to, that it's just, it becomes sad to me that we would avoid something like that.
And then I think,
for myself, like thinking about time and like why I avoided it for so long was like, for me, like when I think it comes back to when I talk about it, it makes it more real. And like we said, that avoidance of it, because one day it'll just all be done. And I think for me, like, whatever done is, for whatever, like, whether there's an afterlife, whatever your, but like, that one day, the life that I'm living right now will end. And I think that that is a very, like, scary topic. Like, when, again, when I was 22, okay, cool. Now that I'm 32, the idea that my, like, I'm still comfortable with the idea and understand that that will happen. But like, there are times I lay in bed at night and I'm like, my kid's not going to have a mom one day. Like, I'm just not going to be there. And like, I get like that overwhelmed panic and I get that anxiety. And I think that, I think sometimes that is the fear too, is like when I talk about it, it's that even though we all know it, it's, there's no avoiding it, but it just brings it to the forefront. And like, when I bring it to the forefront, that anxiety sets in for me. And that anxiety that, again, I know that I could possibly not be here tomorrow. I hope that I'm here tomorrow, and I hope that I'm here for all of these other things, but it's also just a reminder. I think sometimes, like, I think about like how fragile things are, and how, I don't know the word that I'm looking for, but like, I mean, just like how fragile our existence is. Like, again, tomorrow could just not be here. And for whatever reason, I could die in my sleep. I could go out and have the most hilarious death story of like, oh, she went out, she slipped, and something happened. Like, that's what I think is so scary, is when we think about it too hard, we realize like how fragile we are. I don't know.
I'm with you though. I think those are good points, because when I really think about it, I don't think it's healthy to think about it in certain ways all of the time. And I might be the outlier. I think for people with anxiety, for people with death anxiety, it's really important to like know how to direct those thoughts to make sure that like, you know, it's not causing more harm for you or more stress. But I do think avoidance is probably not the answer when it, like, if I just think about it generally. But when you really think about it, life is really fragile. You know, you don't really know how much time you have. And I think that alone can be unsettling, because I think people want to stay here to see it through. You know, I think that's really the key, is like, I just want to experience more, and I just want to be here, and I want to like have all the fun and do all the things. And death means there is an end to that, you know, and then I won't be able to do more things. And then I think of spirituality, and I think of just, I'm trying not to bring my spirituality too much into this, but I think like that attachment to that might be causing more harm, you know, depending on who it is, you know, depending on the person. If we are so concerned with, okay, I'm going to die one day and it's all going to end, and then it's going to stop me from doing the things I want to do. I think of certain people who might say, oh, then nothing matters. Like, mm-hmm. if I'm going to die, then nothing matters. And then there's other people that might say, well, nothing matters. This is cool. I could do whatever I want, you know? So I think it depends on your perspective too, and anxiety and your own traumas and your own lens and culture too, when you think about this. So.
Yeah. I want to make a point on the fragility part, but I just made an observation, and this goes back to cultural norms. So we're all wearing black, which I don't think we meant to do.
Well, but
that's
shit.
Also a very cultural westernized norm. Like, you wear black to funerals, and it's like grief and sadness and mourning. And if that is our conceptualization of death, it's definitely going to impact, I guess, how we view these conversations. So side note, tangentially related, but going back to the fragility piece, Kaiten, I love what you just said about kind of like, for some people, they'd be like, well, then nothing matters. And other people would be like, oh, cool, nothing matters. And I think even if we all know, like, death means that the person is no longer living on Earth, if we have that same basic conceptualization, I mean, I guess that's generalizing. Some people might have a different view. It's what you do with that information. Cause I've definitely seen people, exactly like you said, okay, life is fragile. Oh my gosh, I'm going to be panicked. I'm going to be, you know, making sure everything is in order, whether that means like I'm doing the same routine every day to ensure like nothing bad happens, and it can kind of consume their life. Or it can be like, life is really fragile. Why am I not out living the life I want to live every moment of every day and taking advantage of it? And I've seen that a lot. I obviously don't work with older adults, but, you know, end of life with my teens, like, what are things you want to do before you die? You know, are there like values that you want to live out and things like that? And I know other cultures very much take that approach of just living life to the fullest, because like we said, no death is inevitable. So why are we spending all our time worrying about when death is going to happen versus living a life? Like, we know death is going to happen. So why worry about when versus just continuing to live? And going back to what Justin said, I think our culture makes that really hard because we're like, hustle, 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 work harder, which doesn't align with many people's values and goals. So I think, you know, we can all say, yes, agree, life is fragile, but what we do with that concept may dictate how we decide to live out our lives.
Yeah. I also think we should be afforded the ability to explore this when we're not unwell. I mean, aren't we all unwell? I know everyone on this podcast is.
True.
KBI with the face. But no, I there is a part of me that I think about that. Of like, there's something about being able to have the conversation, you know, in almost a calm manner, in a curious manner, instead of having it to be, you know, I think about that for myself. Of like, I would prefer to be able to make these requests or talk to people about living and dying and explore my own meaning making on that when it's not so dire. And maybe that opens you up if you're listening to kind of think about it in that terms, but it doesn't have to take away from your living to think about this natural cycle of things.
And I would argue talking about it when we are well, going back to this westernized concept of it being scary, it becomes more normalized. And, you know, it just is another conversation. And like KBI brought up earlier, and your goals and things may change, but if you're willing to have conversations when you're well and introduce that to the people around you, maybe they're more willing to have conversations, and it makes this idea of death less scary, foreign, terrifying, whatever word you want to use. And you're preparing better because you're not engaging in that avoidance that we've been talking about.
Oh yeah. I just think about all the times where like my clients have told me, or my friends have told me, like, I was in like an existential hole this weekend, like just thinking about this stuff, how amazing it would be to be able to talk about all that together, you know, or just share those moments of like, We're allowed to disagree. We're allowed to think differently, you know, and you're like, to Jess's point, you're allowed to change your mind. You're allowed to change your mind if you feel a certain way now. And then a couple of years down the line, you're like, oh no, I definitely don't want a DNR, or I do, or something like that. That's okay. You're allowed to change your mind. But I think, to Justin's point, allowing that process to happen affords you those opportunities to make informed decisions about what you want or what you don't want.
And again, those decisions can change over time. So again, like if you're talking about those decisions at 25, those can change when you hit 45 and 65 and 75, and also understanding that that can change with, like, that's okay. And again, that we're continually having those conversations. Because again, like, 22-year-old Kristen had a very different approach to death than 32, and I will have a very different approach to death when I'm 65 and 92. And just always constantly having that conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was 2 years ago where you wanted us to spread your ashes in a Dunkin' Donuts. So,
and we were really trying to say, please don't do it.
I'm telling you, this has been a common conversation with my husband about what my plans are if I die. And it's that I want to be, because we talked about, right, we're all wearing black. In Western culture, it's we're somber, we're sad. I don't want you fuckers to be sad. I want you to be sad for like a moment. Just a moment. Because my presence in your life is glorious.
A text exchange. But
for a moment. Yeah, just like
we're sad.
I missed that. I just, sad emoji, cry face. Okay. But one. I literally said, I don't want to sit. I was like, I don't want to be married. I want to be cremated, and put me in motherfucking fireworks. We're going to have a big wake and we're going to set off fireworks. And set me off, and we all enjoy some fireworks. We get a couple kegs and we have a good fucking party. I don't want anybody in blue. Well, actually, you can wear black because I feel like that solidifies who I am. But like, I don't want, I mean, people are going to cry and it's normal because that's grief. But I also, I want people, like, we see those TikToks, like people going up and being like, she was so nice and she, but no, don't lie about me up there.
Nobody's going to say that about you, KBI. It's fine.
I want to have fun, and I want people to reminisce and not kind of stick in that somber, because every funeral I've ever gone to, we are so stuck in somber. And I think it has a place. And I don't want to say don't grieve and don't feel bad that someone dies and don't feel bad like if I die. But it's more like celebrate that you, like we talked about that dash, right? That time in between birth and death. Like, celebrate the times that we had. Like, I want to hear laughter at my wake. Like, I want to know that there was like laughter there, or I'll just haunt you all. That's,
as I say, you're really gonna, like, I was gonna say you're gonna sit up from the casket, but you want to be cremated, so never mind.
No, that would be that would
it
be
sounds
something
bad to say, but in what you described, I can't wait. Like, I want to
I want to do it now. I want
to
do it.
You need to go first.
Get ahead of it.
Is what Justin's saying.
I mean, I'm not saying that, but I'm saying, what a privilege that you described something that I would love to attend.
I love.
It's true.
Does that make sense? I know it makes sense.
It does. I can't wait for you to die. Like, I just, I want to have a party.
I want, like, it's okay if people, like, I said to my husband, I was like, it's okay if you're sad. And I looked at him, I was like, if you don't cry, I'm fucking haunting you. Like, but like, it's okay to be sad. And like, but like, I also just, I want to be celebrated, because I want, instead of focusing on that I'm no longer here, focus on the things that we did while I was, and whatever whatever it is, because there's plenty of time to be sad afterwards. Because we all know how grief works. But like, imagine me being blown up in fireworks.
I can see it. I can see it.
I'm just going to go.
These other two are covering their faces, but me and you are on the same plan.
I'm just
like,
going to go out with a bang.
Literally.
Literally.
Ha, ha, ha.
I might not be around for it, but I'm excited
for Justin's
it.
Yeah, Justin's old. Justin is like ancient. He's ancient. He's not going to make it. So, like, you got to die soon. So, Justin's here for it. You know, like, figure it out, KBI. Come on. Like,
I mean, it's a good thing that you're saying this to me now, because maybe last year's Kristen would have been like, send it. Let's go.
Fuck it.
Yeah.
I
But I think like, but even then, like you can like, I am serious in that. In like, that's how I would like my wake to be. But like,
again,
it doesn't have to be this super sad thing all the time. Like, I know people who've written their own eulogies and they've written their own obituaries and things like that, because they're like, I want to make sure they just get it right. Like, I was not a fun presence to be around. I was a dick. Like, I, like, people will do that because they're like, I just want it to be real. I want it to be talked about. I want it to be, and you can have those conversations in a way that don't have to be overwhelmingly sad and heavy. It's heavy. It just, that's the nature of it. But it doesn't have to fully be that way.
Yeah. I love that, because I think celebration of life could be a really good way to like honor the person. Cause I got to your point. I mean, it's not always sad. I mean, generally, like when you think about, like, if you reflect on a friendship with somebody, you have great moments, you have great times, you know? I think about my grandpa telling me all of the times that he attended wakes. And he's very Italian. He was very Italian. And, in Brooklyn, he said, yeah, we just put the body on the table and everybody we'd be eating lunch. You know, the body's on the table in the kitchen. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, is this real? You know, is this a story? I don't want to go that way. You're not going that way. We're not putting you on the table. It's not happening. Put me on the table. Just eat. I'm like, I'm not eating around a dead body. First of all, like, it's not happening.
I have questions.
He got cremated. End of story. But I'm like, we're not doing this.
Did he still sit on the table?
He wanted to be cremated too. But anyways, yeah.
Was he still on the table?
Like, is food around the body? Like, is
it was in the kitchen.
Body?
He and me and my brother to this day can't tell if he was fucking with us or if he was serious. But like, there are other people who like corroborate this stuff, and we're just like, was this the norm in Brooklyn in like the 50s, 60s? Like, what was going on?
They were making cold cuts around the body. You know?
Like the
main. Yeah, like
I'm envisioning the casket like there, and then there's like the charcuterie board next to it, and then there's the like dips and stuff, and it's like we're getting our food while saying our condolences,
saying our goodbyes to, you know, Mima. It's like, wait, what is going on? Yeah, so
if you think, to KBI's point, because KBI found something we were paralleled on. Would you rather go to the somber, avoidant funerals? And no, this is, again, fine. If that's what you want, that's what you want. I mean, we're not taking that away from you. But would you rather make a cold cut next to grandpa's body?
I make a cold cut. You know?
This clam dip's delicious. You want a bite?
But I think my point is everybody wants something different, you know? So it's like, I think it's okay to, like you said, have that somber experience. It's okay to have something off the wall. Like what I just described, it's something, it's okay. You know what I mean? It's okay. I used to make fun of my grandpa all the time for this story. So he's rolling around just laughing right now, I think. But I do think about all of those experiences of like, how do I tell people what I want? You know, and if I have to really think about what I want, I definitely want to be cremated. But I was reading about this. I want to see if you guys know about this. You could become a tree. Have you read about this? I want to do that so bad. I want
to
become a tree.
You can send your ashes to be made into an heirloom diamond.
What?
I would not want to be stuck in a diamond.
Can you imagine you're just stuck in a diamond on somebody's finger, like going to the post office? Like, you're just like,
could you imagine? Hey, honey, will you marry me? This is my dead grandma.
Oh my God.
Stop. Hey, for some people, it could be sentimental, you know?
Okay. But here's the thing. Like, if that's what it takes, all this pressure that I'm under, and to be finally made into a diamond, like...
Hey.
Yeah. You're better off as a firework. You're better. You just... Yeah, it's just more...
Firework is more...
Baby,
it's more you.
It's more you.
It's more you.
I also...
Katy Perry playing in the background.
Oh, God.
Yeah, of course. Of course. There's not another song choice.
Wrecking Ball.
I saw...
That's you.
Wrecking Ball.
All right, go ahead. Cool. Sorry.
No, I was going to say, before I say this, I was like, I know we're kind of like joking around and making lighthearted, but I think that's also important because that's how these conversations can happen. But I saw a TikTok the other day that was, it was basically like, I learned today that if you like get buried in a casket and wear a bra, your family gets to decide if you want to be buried in a bra. And it was like, to all my family, please don't. So any bra wearers, that's something that you might want to consider in your wishes. If you want to be, if you're not going to be cremated, I wouldn't want to be buried in a bra. I also want to be cremated. But like, they're so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, why? I was going to say, maybe I do to try something different, but yeah, maybe it's too late at that point.
It's never
too
late. But
to your point about the nature, even to process where this conversation went. Any conversation that starts becoming less stigmatized becomes more open to humor. This is when things are less super somber and serious and full of stigma, it's one tone. But I think it's interesting, even in the trajectory, that this often feels like a group process. When stigma becomes less, you talk about it in different contexts with different emotions. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, that means, yeah, the stigma became less because you were able to actually talk about it in multiple tones.
Maybe you can play a would you rather game to bring it up. Would you rather be buried in a bra or not? Would you rather be a firework or a diamond? Like,
okay. I mean,
I'm just like, be that on just, Granny's that kitchen table or in a funeral home.
Yeah, yeah. On a table next to the cold cut. But like, I mean, because even just how our discussion has gone, reflecting, like, I feel like it started much more somber because that is westernized, like how we talk about death, dying. And this isn't to minimize the experience of death and dying, but going back to that theme of how do we even approach these conversations? If difficult topics are hard for you, but humor is easy for you, approach it with some humor and see how that lands. But it opens the door to more serious conversation. Like, yeah, you can start with, would I rather be next to the cold cuts or in a funeral home? But that might lead to deeper discussions about cremation, DNR, well wishes, things like that. So I don't think there's a wrong way to approach these things, assuming you know your audience and the person you're talking to.
The Welcome to Group Therapy pod is going to release a deck of cards to help you process your death and dying. And yeah, we're going to trademark that shit. Okay. The merch is going to drop. Bring it to your next little happy hour gathering social group. Pull a card, Johnny. Would you rather be a diamond or a firework?
We're going to make sure
people are like, I got the firework card. Like,
when you said merch, all I can think of is Grandpa's Cold Cut Company.
He was so Italian. Like, it was painful. It was painful sometimes. I was like, in a good way. Like,
I just need a time machine because I'm really, like, I'm going to be thinking about this all night of how that worked.
I'm going to call my cousin after this and just ask her if, like, what her actual thoughts are. And I'm just going to record it and I'm going to send it to you guys because it was just. And again, please, we don't know if we still don't know if he was fucking with us. So,
right.
Anybody listening, we don't know if this is true. I just can't imagine at all.
Or if you've been to Italian funerals, please DM us and let us
please
know.
Please DM us because I don't attend funerals.
In Brooklyn.
Really? Yeah. Yeah.
In the 1950s.
But you know what always is true because it is statistically something.
You got it. Significant. Yeah.
You're good.
Significant. That's the word.
There we go.
Yeah.
Jess's Google Scholar shorts because she looks for the ones that have a good P score.
Okay.
That was solid. Look at you. Solid. Look at you going.
Look at me. Should have done a dissertation.
Should have done all this energy because
she knows she's going to be a firework. It could be so healing talking about death, right? I mean,
yeah. That's right.
So I feel like my article is going to be kind of taking the tone down after our lively discussion, but it's fine. So we talked a little bit about our experiences talking about it in therapy. So the question I'm going to pose to you all is, what effects do you believe music therapy has on specifically hospice patients? So we didn't explicitly talk about hospice, but people at end of life, not going to have a cure, usually don't want medical intervention, as well as their caregivers. KB is like super excited about this.
Oh, it's because I know it. So keep going. Well, I think I do. It has a positive effect.
Yeah.
Same.
Okay. On patients and caregivers.
Yes.
Both.
Yeah.
Okay. So this study came out this year. It was a 3-week music therapy intervention with 3 to 4 music therapy sessions. important to note that, because obviously with hospice patients, usually people aren't living for a long period of time. So for hospice patients, with regard to symptom burden, the overall mean scores on their measure of symptom severity was 6.8 points lower after music therapy from baseline, with significant symptom reductions in the areas of pain, nausea, appetite, shortness of breath, depression, and anxiety. Hospice patients also showed significant improvement with regard to quality of life. And then from a qualitative standpoint, patient satisfaction with music therapy treatment was overall positive, with patients describing the treatment as beneficial for stress relief, relaxation, spiritual support, emotional support, and general overall feeling well. So exactly like you said, very positive outcomes. With regard to caregivers, mental, physical, emotional, social, spiritual, pain frequency, and pain severity scores were lower for caregivers, and then their perceived support from family and friends was higher. However, interestingly, overall quality of life decreased at the end of the 3-week music therapy intervention, and caregiver fatigue and caregiver stress was higher. So although music therapy appears to have beneficial effects for patients on hospice care, especially with regard to like overall quality of life, caregivers actually showed a dip in their quality of life, which this article summarized that, yes, there's therapeutic potential for music therapy for patients, but we also need to underscore and explore interventions that may be tailored specifically for caregivers as well, and what might work for patients that are at end of life may not necessarily work for those taking care of them. I also want to note small sample size and obviously short term, given the nature of the sample.
Who picked the music?
Let me pull up the article and see.
I know I put you immediately on blast. This is just the nuance I think about with stuff like that. I know when my dad was in hospice and passing away, we played the shit out of Johnny Cash on repeat because my dad loved Johnny Cash and the Beatles. Do I love Johnny Cash? Yeah. I'm sentimental because my dad did, but like you're not going to catch me bumping Johnny Cash in my car anytime. Yeah. But just interesting factors. But I know when my dad was passing, that was really there's something very connecting about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to know who has the aux, you know?
Yeah. Who had the aux there? Who's DJing here?
Well, I remember in grad school, I watched this documentary, The Voice Inside or something like that. And it was following patients with pretty severe dementia, and they played music that was from like their early 20s, like music that they enjoyed. And it's called Alive Inside. That's what it's called. And you watch them kind of come to life in a way. Like a lot of these dementia patients, they were kind of catatonic. And so I figured it would be kind of similar for that end of life piece of kind of having a similar effect, like that positive feeling, that was stress reduction, all of that.
Totally.
So I'm going to be completely transparent. Now the article is not giving me full access as I'm trying to pull it up in this short period of time.
Somebody picked that music. It was just a variable. But I think about that for the caregivers screw this.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's a good point. If it's like my 90-year-old grandfather picked Frank Sinatra, and that is not my jam.
Frank Sinatra at the same time. That's so weird.
Yeah. I think of Frank Sinatra because my grandfather, getting into a personal story, after he died, we all went to the beach, and those of drinking age drank. I was a minor at the time, and sang My Way. I also just had my tonsils taken out. It was a whole mess of things. My Way by Frank Sinatra, because we always said like he did it my way, because 10 years earlier, he died on a treadmill and was resuscitated. And he goes, I have never exercised a day in my life. I was not going to die on a treadmill. He was doing a stress test.
Good for him. Oh my God.
And so he lived 10 years later and died after eating dinner with a drink in his hand while taking a nap.
and had a heart attack. So he did it his way. Like, he went out.
Beautiful.
Yeah, exactly. So that's why I think of Frank Sinatra around death. But it just says board certified music therapist in the abstract.
One thing,
but I will find the full article again because I literally did this from home 2 days ago. So I know I had access to it.
One thing we have full access to is the polls, baby. Give me that poll data. Thank y'all for jumping into our stories, just being far more than a data point, but a point of inspiration for each and every one of us. Y'all share your stories, you're vulnerable, you're authentic. Hey, how old were you when you first had a memorable experience with death/grief? In childhood, teenage/young adult, 25 to 35, or I haven't yet.
I'm going to say teenage/young adult.
Childhood, 59%.
Oh, really? Wow.
Teenage, young adult, 32, 6% of our great group members, 25 to 35, 3%, I haven't yet. Have you talked to a loved one about your end of life preferences or care? Yes, no, or not yet?
I know or not yet, but I don't know which one.
How about 44% said yes?
Oh, let's go.
32% said no. 24 said not yet. And then I just asked, you know, I asked our group members, they're always thoughtful and on it. Why do you think we avoid talking about death or dying? Someone says, I don't want to think about what we're leaving behind related to what KBI has been bringing up. Mm. We're supposed to be winners. We don't like to lose. Oh, wow. That fits in to that American philosophy I was saying. Discomfort, not really knowing how. It feels too sad because we're afraid. Too many unknowns. It feels, quote, scary. Avoidance feels taboo. It's too much to try to comprehend. And seems like too far in the future. A lot of scaries, uncomfortable, and emotions it brings up. And then lastly, to what degree do you feel comfortable talking or thinking about end-of-life care requests? Very comfortable, somewhat comfortable, not comfortable, or I'm unsure.
Somewhat comfortable.
Somewhat comfortable, 42%. 31% of people are very comfortable. We got our group members. 20% not comfortable. It's all right. And 6% were unsure. Y'all, thanks for participating and not avoiding those polls.
But you know what our group members never avoid too? The questions.
Of course.
So I was in charge of questions this week. We actually covered a good chunk of them in our discussion, which was really cool. So I picked out a couple for us to go over. So E from North Carolina has a kind of interesting question that we touched upon a little bit, but didn't really dive into. And it is around grief, but I think it's around the different types of death. So why do different causes of death make grief harder or less straightforward or complex? For example, when my granny died of cancer when I was 12, it was the hardest thing in my life. Until my uncle died last year of addiction. I dealt with 5 familial deaths in between those two, and it's not a linear path for sure. But do you have insight into why addiction loss might have a different impact than even something like suicide or even cancer? So, like, I think, like, when it comes to those different types of loss and those different types of deaths, I think they all can impact us so differently.
I think it depends on your relationship with the person, too, and maybe how close you were. And I don't have much experience with addiction and drug use, you know, from a clinical perspective. On a personal note, I could imagine most people would probably feel like it's really hard, you know, because it just depends. I keep saying stuff and then I keep going back. It depends. But who knows? I think maybe it could be the connection that you have with the person, maybe how you are perceiving the death, how you found out, your current state, how you think about death. I mean, all these factors play a role, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think factors are a huge part in it because, I mean, being transparent, when we lose someone to death at 92, there's kind of an acceptance that's already begun to happen as someone ages up into that range versus someone dying at 25. And And there is, I personally feel, sometimes a different response. It doesn't mean that we care more or less about that, but I think that as someone ages, as we get older, we become more accepting that that is coming up, that that's going to be something that happens. And I think that, again, that nuance of some of those pieces play a huge role in that.
I agree. And I think it really gets caught up in bargaining, meaning in related to what you're saying, when somebody dies at 93, I think there's sort of less of that bargaining. I think most of us say things like they've lived a full life. But when someone dies of substance abuse or accidents or, you know, any number of things, we can feel like, was there something else I could have done? I know I feel that way with my brother. And that's why the bargaining, you know, still kind of continues, where I still wonder, like, if I would have known this or I would have known that, if I would have been through grad school and had a better understanding of the cycle of addiction and bipolar, you know, could I have made a difference? But I think that's why it becomes so hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also think how you conceptualize death in general, but also at the age, because I know, like you said, Granny died of cancer at 12. Like, you were very young, as well as like how much you can prepare for it. So, like, you know, for example, one of my grandfathers died of a heart attack, the one I just mentioned. The other died of prostate cancer and lived, well, lived with prostate cancer for like 20 years, but he was given 6 months to live and lived like over 3 years. So for like that whole time, like, I was preparing any day to get a phone call, and, you know, I knew any time I saw him could be my last. So I lived my life very differently with him versus, you know, my cousin who died by suicide or my friend who died of a brain tumor. Like, I think, you know, the age, the preparation, your conceptualization of death, if you think death is something that only happens to elderly people, that's going to impact it. Like we keep saying, I think there's so many factors. And I just want to reiterate what KBI said. Like, it doesn't mean you loved a person more or less or cared about them more or less. It's just different. Another thing that just popped into mind, I also, at least in my experience, and I can think of a couple of people in my life that have passed away where I've kind of shamed myself for like not grieving hard enough, but those were people that like I knew were ready to die and not necessarily but like they've lived with a chronic illness. Or even my grandmother, so my grandmother who was married to my grandfather with prostate cancer lived 6 years beyond his death, and like she was miserable those 6 years. Like, and we knew she wanted to be with my grandfather. Like, we have belief in the afterlife and things like that. And so, yes, it was sad, and it was her time. I knew she wanted to go, and I knew she was going to be happier in death with my grandfather based on her beliefs, which for me made it easier. So I think there's so many different factors to weigh in. But I think the point, like KBI said so beautifully, is it doesn't mean you love or care for someone more or less. Grief is just different and complex.
And that really answers Julia from north of Ohio's question, where she said, like, is when someone dies suddenly versus dying over time, like, do we have different reactions in that process? And for many people, they do. And again, it doesn't mean, you know, if you have a strong or not strong reaction. A lot of times when we find someone who has that diagnosis and we're finding out they're dying over time, we kind of start that grief and loss process. Mm-hmm. And again, we're given more time to talk about wants and wishes and things like that versus maybe someone who's died suddenly and hasn't expressed in a way their wants and wishes. And we're just trying, we're flailing a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what Justin mentioned too about bargaining. Like, you think that you have time and you think that you can have that last conversation and you can kind of get closure and you could, you know what I mean? Like, there's a little bit of a, I don't know if this is going to make sense, but like, for some people you have like a pre-grieving process because you know they're sick or you know they're dying or they're aging or something like that. When something happens so suddenly, I think there's bargaining. There's also shock, which is hard to get through. I mean, shock is just like, you're just like, oh shit, you know, like, fuck, this is like, whoa, this happened. And then that overcomes everything. And then you're bargaining and you might be in denial, you know, all of those things. So I think all these things kind of impact the way that people process it and their view of it. Mm-hmm.
And going off of something Justin said earlier too, of like, what could I have done differently? Like, so if it's something sudden, you know, especially I'm thinking like a suicide or drug overdose, like what could I have done differently versus like, if you know, it's a illness or it's a grandparent or other elderly figure, you may approach not even just the grieving process, but how you spend time with them. Like you might be much more aware, like this potentially could be my last time with them. So I'm going to be much more present versus if it's a 25-year-old, you're like, hey man, see you next week. Like, and not, I don't know, at least for me personally, I know looking back, if I knew somebody was more at the end of life, that the intentionality of spending time with them looked a lot different.
Brittany from Canada, how would you approach the topic of death with your children in an age-appropriate way?
Man, the variability here is vast. It's like,
well, yeah.
What do people do? People, I think, often carry the frames in religious beliefs or spiritual beliefs into these conversations. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that per se. You know what I mean? If, you know, not to get into debates about, you know, the religion, but I think that's what people do is like, oh, you know, in Christianity, this is what we believe, or in Buddhism, this is how we think about life and death and the cycle. And so I think people bring this in. I think there's certainly a lot of good books that exist out there in child form about, you know, coming into birth and living and how all things do come to an end and die. I think there's ways that you can talk about that. Mm-hmm. I immediately start thinking of like, what's the age of the child? Like, mm-hmm. are they asking questions? Yeah. Do you just want to normalize, you know, that people are coming into this world and people are going out of this world?
Well, I think like how I would talk to my 6-year-old is very different than how I would talk to a 14-year-old about, mm-hmm. about death.
So, like, right.
You know, last year we had to put one of the family dogs down because she was really sick and it was her time. And, you know, I don't even still think he conceptualizes what that is. We talked about the Rainbow Bridge and that she's no longer mm-hmm. with. And for a very long time, like he was like, where's Pukaya? Where's Pukaya? We're like, oh, buddy, she went to the Rainbow Bridge. And, you know, I don't even think he'll conceptualize that, even what exactly that is, until he gets even older, because, you know, his little brain just probably isn't there yet developmentally. And mm-hmm. the best that I think that we can do specifically around like when we're talking about it is holding space, especially mm-hmm. at any age specifically, but especially for younger kiddos who may have a even more struggle time just because developmentally, like holding space that they just may not understand.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. I think so. A lot of the research shows that like until age 7, kids really can't even conceptualize this idea of death. Like they can repeat it. So like, for example, and Justin, exactly like you said, I think people bring in their spiritual beliefs or beliefs after death. You know, my daughter was 10 months when my friend died. So she like obviously didn't know, but like I have pictures of her or things like that. And she'll ask and I'll say, oh, well, Claire's in heaven. And like, she'll point to the sky and she can repeat that. Mm-hmm. But like, she doesn't really know. Or like when my in-law's dog died, we said, you know, Tux is no longer here. He's in heaven. And like, she can point to the sky and that's about her extent of knowledge. So I think it's age dependent. I think it also depends on like why you're bringing it up, because one thing working in a hospital I have seen is people tend to avoid the topic of death with children because they are uncomfortable. Kids know something's different. Even if they can't conceptualize death for what it is, they may know like well, this person is no longer visiting my house anymore, or we're no longer going to grandma's. So I think whatever your beliefs are, you know, if somebody is sick and dying, you know, explaining like so-and-so is really sick and might not get better. So it really just depends. I don't think you have to like bring up death and dying for like no reason for kids out of the blue, especially if they're younger. But I would definitely say like, if you're bringing it up because somebody in their life is dying or has died, avoiding it is not going to be helpful, because I have seen so many parents and caregivers avoid the topic of death, especially like siblings of my patients. And it's worse outcomes because the kids feel like they're being lied to because they know something is going on. And they feel like they're being left. So yeah, or finding books that can be helpful. Asking them, do you have questions? You know, grandma's been really sick. I know we've told you she's in the hospital. What questions do you have? And let them guide, because that will give you a lot of information. And then you're not oversharing, because they might just be like, is she going to come home? Well, we don't know that. Okay. Is she in pain or does she hurt? No, doctors are giving her medicine. Okay, cool. Can we go do something else? Great. That's the discussion there. So I think it really depends on so many factors. But I know you didn't say, you asked how to approach it. Don't avoid it. That doesn't really answer it, but don't avoid it would be my advice.
Truth.
Allie from Kentucky says, as clinicians, how do you see individuals' thoughts and fears about mortality intercede with their presenting symptoms?
I think I usually see what their presenting symptoms are.
Yeah. I would say I probably see the most with like anxiety.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where it intercedes a lot with
depression. Yeah. For people who, particularly people who are suicidal, you know, I think about their thoughts about death, how comfortable they are with it, how comfortable we are talking about it, stuff like that. But yeah, I think I, at least in my own experience, I work with a lot of people with anxiety, you know, traditional GAD, you know, and when I think about death and dying and how we talk about it, there is a twinge of anxiety, a twinge of worry, you know, naturally just based on, the topic itself. But then I think for someone who might present with anxiety with a whole range of topics, it's no surprise that they might be anxious about this too, you know? So I think about that too. For people who don't have that much anxiety that I work with, and it's come up, I'm recalling a couple of instances. There's more of like a curiosity, but like an avoidance with it, you know? But I think it depends on the person. And like we said, there's so many variables.
Someone from Pittsburgh, and I thought that this was interesting because we talked about coping like with us talking about death, but this one, it says, I often think about what it'd be like to lose my mom. I'm close with her and I've lost two loved ones already. I don't think I'll be okay when that happens. How do I prepare for that day?
What do you mean you won't be okay? You know, is this us avoiding emotions that we're not allowed to be sad, or we're not allowed to be, you know, upset or miss them? Or because I think you're right. Like, if you love her, you cherish her, she brings meaning into your life, why would you be, you know, okay in terms of you're going to have a lot of emotions and there's going to be real grief and loss, which is just the consequence of loving someone or having them in your life. And I think having frames, I'm just going to say the word frames 1,000 more times, having frames of understanding of how natural this whole thing of birth and death is, whether that's, you know, spiritual, religious, just understanding of how you make meaning out of that. If you have taken anything from this podcast, put some energy into that. You can read some books, you can have conversations, but I think that's imperative, because otherwise you just avoid what is natural, which I don't care if you're religious, I don't care if you're spiritual, but to me, the most unnatural thing is to avoid what is coming for all of us. And so the conversations, the explorations, listening to podcasts, reading books, I think that's great for everyone, regardless of who you might think about passing away being difficult for you.
Mm-hmm. I love that because you could always learn something about yourself, you know, and the people around you and maybe what they want or what they don't want. But I appreciate everybody joining us today for this topic. I know it seems like a heavy one. And like we've described and what we've experienced in this group session, it could also be a little light depending on the humor and depending on who you're talking to. But we really appreciate you stopping by. We really appreciate you listening. We always love your group questions, especially about topics that are like this. So important to create space for stuff like this and have these open conversations. So send this to the group chat, lighten it up a little, send them a pod about death and dying. They might like it. And we'll see you next week in group therapy.
Bye.
Bye.